Hi, this is Larry DiTullio, writer for He-Man and Beast Wars, and you are listening to the GeekCast Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to the GeekCast Radio Network. This will be an interview featured on Tooncast and the Beast Unleashed podcast. I'm your host, TFG1 Mike, and joining me is Michael Wilson. Hello, sir.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going. Today we are here with the man who is responsible for writing on shows like He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, Hypernauts, Babylon 5, and Beast Wars. Here's Larry DiTullio. Hello, sir.
Hi, Mike and Michael.
How are you?
No, I'm good.
Good. Very good. Very good. It's a real pleasure to talk to you because you have no idea. I grew up on He-Man, and it was just amazing.
So did I.
Yeah, you created the stories. We watched them.
That's pretty amazing, yes.
Yes. So getting a little background information on you, where did you grow up, sir?
I grew up in New York City, the old country, Queens, Ozone Park, right behind Aqueduct Racetrack. And I moved after college. I went to NYU, and then I came out to Los Angeles, where I live now, to go to UCLA graduate school. And I wanted to be a film writer. It seemed logical to come out to Hollywood if I wanted to be a film writer. So I got my master's at UCLA, and then I went, pounding the pavement, looking for a job.
So what was it, Larry, that got you interested in writing? You said you moved out to Hollywood to become a film and television writer. What was it, that really got you into writing?
I like to be the guy in control, and the writer is the guy in control. The story is everything. Even if you're working on a toy show, story is everything. Sometimes they don't realize that, so that's where arguments get fought. But I'm more than happy to fight those arguments because writing it's a sacred thing, writing. You have to dedicate yourself to it, and you never get any sun. You sit in your house all day. You get hemorrhoids. You do it for 30 years, and you're sitting 10 feet higher than you used to. I liked everything that was on. So I was born in 1948, so Saturday mornings were not a lot of cartoons. There were a lot of Western stuff like Sky King and My Friend Flicka and Lassie and all those kids' drama, half-hour dramas for kids, really. They were interesting. I had never planned to go into cartoons at all. That never even crossed my mind. I was a comic book fan. I liked comics when I was a kid and superheroes and that kind of stuff. The usual stuff, Superman, Batman, even Captain Marvel was being printed when I was a kid. I said, I want to do this, I want to write. And I want to write for this medium that moves, this action medium. I'm not that interested in writing prose, although I've kind of changed on that over the years. But TV and movies was what I liked, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a movie writer, and I started as a movie writer and then later got moved into television because my movie career wasn't going anywhere. And then after about 13 years of pounding the pavement, I got a shot on He-Man. Through Michael Halperin. If you're a He-Man fan, you should know that name.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. He did the original Bible for it, and him and we were friends in the Writers Guild. I did join the Writers Guild in 1971. Yeah, it was 1971. And that's I did this feature called The Madman Movie Makers, which was kind of a spoof of porno movies. And that got me in, and it was for basically a mafia-based company. And it had nothing to do with me being Italian. They just my agent said, "Hey, they want you to write this movie." And I said, "Well, yeah, I'd love to write a movie." And it was a comedy, and it came out, and it got some viewing because it played with the first incarnation of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was on a double bill. That's when they used to have double bills as well. My family had to go see it and sit through. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was kind of interesting. It didn't go much of any place, but it did get me into the Writers Guild, and that was what started my career. Then in after the first movie came out, it wasn't great shakes. In a couple of years, I hocked around trying to sell things to mainly comedy. I wanted to be a comedy writer. Stuff like The Odd Couple was going on then, and I was pitching to those people. And I did get a shot on, what was the show? It was The Odd Couple. That's what it was. That's right. Through Jerry Belson and Gary Marshall. And Gary Marshall brought me in the office after I did this script, kind of a spec script for him, which I wasn't supposed to do because I was in the Writers Guild. But he called me in and he said, "Listen, kid," he said, "there's two kinds of funny." He says, "There's funny zany and there's funny weird." He says, "We're funny zany and you're funny weird." And that kind of got me out of comedy. I kind of thank Gary Marshall. I still would love to write a comedy show, but I just never got the chance. And I got kind of more to be a dramatic writer, and then I got into cartoons through Michael. And I got through that. I got to that because Michael's sons played D&D, which I did as well. I was considerably older than them at the time, but I had been article for The Dragon, which was a D&D magazine.
Right.
It wasn't an article, it was a dungeon. So, you know, it actually was kind of like doing a movie. The dungeons were kind of like doing movies. And he said, "Hey, I didn't know you wrote Sword and Sorcery." He called me up and said, "Larry, you write Sword and Sorcery?" I said, "Well, yeah, I do." And he said, "Well, you gotta come in here because, you know, they're doing He-Man at Filmation and they need plenty of writers. And go in there and speak to Arthur Nadell, who's the producer, and, you know, see what you can come up with." So I said, "Thank you, Mike," and I made an appointment with Arthur, and I showed him. I had a few credits at that time. One was the movie, and the others were little bitty religious shows. I worked on a religious show at one point.
Really?
Yeah, it was one of the, you know, the Sunday shows that was a Lutheran. Two Lutheran ministers were the producers. That was during the Vietnam era, and I did it was actually after the war had finished, but I did a thing about a Vietnam vet coming back who saves this junkie's life. A wino that saves a junkie's life. They were pretty nice about that. and they said, except one character has to be the voice of God. I said, "Take your pick, junkie or wino. I'll go either way." You know, that was kind of a strange story, and it actually, I don't think it ever actually got on the air, but it was my first live action piece, and I started being sent on more live action for that. But you know, that this was well before He-Man happened. So I went to see Arthur Nadell, and he was for some reason impressed by. I had done a biography of Napoleon and Hitler, so I suppose that, and I did that in a half an hour, so that was I guess that showed that I could write briefly and still get a lot of information in there. I worked for a show called Against the Odds, which was hosted by Bill Bixby. It was biographies for kids. And I came, I became their what they call their warrior writer. Every bloodthirsty dictator that that went through history, I got this assignment on after writing Hitler and Napoleon. And that's how we got started in the business, actually.
Nice. Well, that kind of starts you off, but what are you doing recently? We looked on IMDb for research, but we didn't see much for you for the last couple of years.
There's not much. You know, no, because I got old. And when they get old, they don't want you anymore.
Really?
And unless you're really, really grandfathered in there, like nobody's calling me up saying, hey, would you like to write this? Would you like to write that? Unless it's some old friend of mine. Seriously, I'm not much looking for work, and that's why I haven't done anything in 5 years. Usually if I'm looking for work, I'll go get it, you know. Now I'm thinking of writing a book that's the saga of my family and my life, I guess. I guess that's an old age thing with writers. You know, you get older, you say, oh, maybe I should write about myself and my family.
Like a memoirs or an autobiography or something?
Yeah, something along that line. You know, there's some interesting stories about my family and stuff, and my wife's family. Books, I was never really, I love reading books, but I was never really big on writing them. I do prefer the moving ones. That's why I never tried to write for comic books. But I know how to do it, but I never wanted to do it. There's something about it destroying your whole love of things. If you work on the inside of things, you know, you start to get very cynical about it. When before, you know, when you're a kid, you're like, oh, wow, this is really great. I'm working on He-Man over here, you know. And then, you know, a couple of years later, you can't get arrested. But that's the way it works. And IMDb there's a lot of things that they don't have on there, and there's some stuff that they credit me with that I never did. So that's I wouldn't trust IMDb. I put that go over there and just give them the information. I do have about 150 credits, and some of the stuff I worked on was Babylon 5. I was a story editor, an executive story editor of that for 2 years.
Well, the IMDb is kind of like a Wikipedia in that anybody can go on there and enter information in. It wouldn't necessarily be you, so it helps to keep on top of those.
Yeah, maybe one day I'd go to Wikipedia and rewrite the very slim article they have on me. You know, what for? I mean, it's nothing that interests me right now. I might do it one of these days.
A lot of people who are interested in you.
In the golden age of kids' cartoons, I worked for CBS mainly. Judy Price liked me for some reason. She was the head of CBS at the time. I worked on Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling, if you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I worked on several low points in cartoon history, and that was a low point because it was a show full of wrestlers, and they said, oh, but you can't have them wrestling because that's too violent.
Really?
Well, then what do we do with them?
That's funny.
I said, they can't wrestle. Like, you know, there's not much, a whole lot we can do with Hulk Hogan and the Iron Sheik, you know. So, that, and then I worked on Galaxy High School. I was also I don't know if you remember that show, which actually should have been a bigger show than it was. That was this.
I don't recall that one.
Yeah, Earth Boy goes to a high school in outer space, you know, and meets all these aliens, and it was like a teen comedy set in outer space. The animation was terrific, and it was pretty good, but it was before its time. And it lasted a year, and in like New York it got, and LA it got good ratings, but the rest of the country just didn't see it, you know. They just never watched it. It was a pretty good show, though. It was TMS's first try at advancing Japanese animation into American culture. Now, of course, we're in. We're in.
Yeah, it's ubiquitous now.
We're in.
Yeah. So
I just went to anime.
As for animated features, what was your favorite show to work on?
My favorite show to work on? All of them. Anything I worked on. No. California Raisins was my most unfavorite. Two of us did the California Raisins, and it was horrible. That was
you know what's
horrible.
Funny about that? A buddy of mine and I were talking about that show the other day, and you'd be surprised how little information there is of California Raisins anywhere. Even finding a clip on YouTube of it, there's nothing.
You mean the cartoon show?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can find plenty on the ads, on the ads for California Raisins. But Will Vinton just got jobbed by Murakami Wolf. They said, oh, well, we can do it. You know, it'll be just as good as, like, your claymation. And, of course, it wasn't, you know. And we did get all in the music. The music was good, but the music was good before there was a cartoon show. So, mm-hmm. You know, it was all soul. I loved soul music. So it was fun. But, you know, when we saw the result of it, it was like, oh, my God, you know. But going from what I hated working on to what I liked working on, He-Man and She-Ra were both great jobs for me, as was Beast Wars. Conan, I wrote a couple of Conans. You remember Conan the Adventurer?
Yep.
The Conan cartoon? That was another one where you couldn't kill anything. And I thought, wait a minute here. This is not going to work, you know. They had the cosmic
pizza. Where's the fun in that?
You could send Snake Man into the cosmic pizza in the sky, and then they'd be gone if you touch them with your sword. I said, well, this is dumb. But I always liked Conan. So Conan was my idol when I got into sword and sorcery and stuff. He was the first, Robert E. Howard, I read everything he wrote. But good luck trying to, like, adapt the Howard story, you know, for that show.
Right. It's too violent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's change gears over to He-Man. Talk about some of the shows you were on. He-Man was one of my favorite cartoons back in the day. We were talking mm-hmm. earlier about, people recognizing you from He-Man. And, you know, when I would come home from school, I watched G.I. Joe, Transformers, and He-Man. So it's like those were formative for me. How easy was it to translate your earlier sword and sorcery work into stories for children's toys?
Actually, my earlier sword and sorcery work was mainly game work. I'm a role-play gamer. And I buy dungeons. That was my main sword and sorcery. That's why I wrote that article for the Dragon. Is because that's where I was writing a lot of sword and sorcery, just for playing with my friends. So
right,
once I got to
that early
sword sorcery for a...
Yeah.
I didn't do anything earlier than He-Man. He-Man was my first cartoon show.
I
had no idea.
Like the Gary Gygax stuff, I'm not sure how well that would translate into, Saturday morning cartoons.
But the principles of role-play gaming follow the principles of a TV show, of making it realistic and a fantasy at the same time. I don't know if that makes any sense, but...
No, it does,
I just took the sword and sorcery stuff I would use when playing around here with my friends and say, well, why don't you stick that into He-Man, you know, because it'll work. My first show, The Dragon's Gift, which that was the first story I sold to He-Man. And that's kind of widely known as the most oddball episode of He-Man ever written, because He-Man loses, for one thing. That was the one that convinced them to hire me on staff. They literally said, you know, we want to hire you on, you know, we want to hire you while I was writing that script. And I said, well, I'm working on the script that I just sold you. They said, well, you'll have to work on that at home because we want to hire you to work over here. And they did.
How did you make the move from He-Man to She-Ra? Who pulled you over to the new project?
There was no move on that. We had done three seasons of He-Man. We had two.
Mm-hmm.
And they were 65 episode seasons.
Right.
So, you know, that's like almost an entire year of work. you know.
Yeah.
Even in limited animation, that was 75% stock footage. That's a lot. That's a lot of work.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So and the other thing was that it was the first time working for a toy company, which is always an interesting and agonizing process. Although we had a good contract on that, so it wasn't as agonizing as most of the other toy shows I worked on.
Right.
Into that later, but yeah, if I ever want to get hired again by any of these people, not that I do. but I didn't really make a move. We were finished with He-Man. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to actually, they were gearing up for like a fourth year of He-Man, and the Horde was supposed to be the villain of that mm-hmm. of that fourth year. And that's because we had the Skeletor syndrome hit He-Man very quickly in the first season of it, which means every story had to start with Skeletor. It really couldn't start with He-Man, which is something I tried to change at the end of the first season, and fairly successfully, I might say. He-Man couldn't do anything until Skeletor made a move. In the first season of the show, those first 65 episodes,
right,
had to hatch a plot. It had to come. I said, this is not right because our hero is not proactive. He should be going after Skeletor, you know, not waiting for Skeletor to come to him and do something terrible to everybody. At first, it was problematic, but Skeletor was really popular, as you know. I mean, the second popular guy on He-Man was Skeletor. That's what people told us in polls. Oh yeah, we love He-Man, but I really love Skeletor too. You know? It was coming to like Megatron and Optimus. You know,
yep.
You kind of got to love them both. You know,
yep.
You got to get into both of their heads, so you got to love them both. You know, you got to say, well, where are they coming from? You know, it's an interesting thing. But I didn't have to be pulled to the new. What happened was somewhere in there, He-Man ceased to become the number one toy in America, and if you'll remember, it was replaced by Cabbage Patch Kids. Very strange. Very strange transition.
Flying off the shelves. Parents fighting for each
other. Yeah. Cabbage Patch Kids. But that was, again, what was going on at that time is there was a big thing about violence in cartoons and how it was making all of you people who were watching the cartoons grow up into psychotic people. You know. Of course,
I always knew the difference, though. I was raised where, like, I know that that's just a cartoon. It's not real.
Yes, I know. The only ones that didn't know the difference was adults.
Yeah.
It was these adults that would get crazy and say, oh, this is going to make you into this. This is going to make you into that. No, it's not. We've had these kind of stories for years, you know. The Bible Bible itself has enough violent stories in it to make you a psychotic. So, it was just an unfortunate period in history that we were doing action shows, and yet action shows were the biggest thing at that point. You know, Transformers, G.I. Joe, that, and then there was Thundar the Barbarian, and all the others. Those were big. They were big shows. The kids liked them.
Oh yeah,
and that's why we did them. We didn't do them right, but you know, because we were constrained by the companies we were working for.
They're still classic nostalgia nowadays, so you guys must have done something correct.
Well, what we did is we told what we did on He-Man and She-Ra was just concentrate on characters and stories. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of characters and story. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Speaking of characters and story, what was the process in creating the backstory for the She-Ra characters?
I didn't do a lot of backstory for She-Ra. Now remember, we had just done like the two years of 65 episodes, so we were all kind of tired. When they gave me She-Ra, I said, okay, it's got to be. And they said, let's make her He-Man's sister. I said, okay, we've done 130 episodes of He-Man, and no one ever mentioned her sister. So I said, oh, what are you going to do? But I wasn't pulled to it. They said, instead of doing He-Man, they were going to do She-Ra. Oh, she wasn't. They didn't know what she was called at the moment, at that time. But the villains would be the Horde that were tended to come in to replace Skeletor and He-Man. And they decided. I think Lou decided that wouldn't work, and maybe they should do something else. And Mattel decided that why don't we do if He-Man is for boys, let's do a female He-Man for girls, you know. And what they wanted in that was a lot of hair play. They said, because that's what girls like, hair play. So everybody had long hair, you know. And I laugh about toy companies because they're very, very passionate about what they do, but what they don't understand from the writer's point of view is we're not writing a story for toys. We're writing a story for people.
Right.
We have to treat them as people, and we have to create them as people so that they will resonate with the people who are watching them. There are not toys watching them. There are people watching them. So whether they're giant robots or, hell, I even wrote for King Kong, that was kind of the last thing I did was Kong. I don't know if you've ever seen that series. I don't think.
Yeah, I remember Kong, the animated series.
Yeah, it was a Saban series. I did one really good script on that, but I've never seen it on TV. And they don't sell box sets of Kong. I had awful experiences over there. I won't say anything more about Saban, because that's what my two worst experiences were, both at Saban. So I'll just give you the one, which is Kong. So it was kind of, I was working with that one with Bob Ford on that as well. The same I work with on Beast Wars. We were all friends from Filmation, by the way. And that's how I got into She-Ra. Now, how we named originally, they wanted to call her Hera, after Zeus's wife.
Right.
And then they went and looked it up, and apparently somebody had a copyright on Hera. I don't know how that could be, but somebody had copyrighted Hera, and they said, we can't use it. I said, well, wait a minute now. What are we going to do here? I said, I liked Hera. I said, well, what we need here is He-Man. Well, obviously, at one point, I suggested She-Ra and the Mistresses of the Universe. And they hit over the head with a fish and said, stop it. Not going to be called.
I remember you. I think you told that story on one of the commentaries.
Yes, I've told them hundreds of times. So I know them by heart. But what I wanted was something that conveyed a godlike power and a female. And I, at the time, I just happened to be reading some Egyptian. I'm big on mythology, and I was reading some Egyptian mythology. And I said, well, Ra is the name, kind of the generic name for God in Egyptian mythology. I said, why don't I? And it sounds kind of like Hera. I said, but it's She-Ra, and it kind of has a musical sound to it. Now, I have to say that my niece's name is She-Ra, but she was not named after the show. And it's spelled differently, but it's pronounced the same. And everybody thinks that I named the show after her, especially her. But I really didn't, because this was before she was born. So
don't tell her.
I wanted to scotch that story for my family, so if they're listening, they'll know it's She-Ra. I just came up with, a female god, She-Ra, and I liked the name. The name was better than Hera. And the problem with us, we couldn't use the sword. We had to just have her make it turn into ropes and stuff like that. The background on the other characters, Glimmer, Frosta, and the oh-so-horrible Casta Stella, what a name that was. We just used to call her Casta. And we said, we're never going to call her Casta Stella. That's too stupid. So we just had people refer to her as Casta in the scripts. And the biggest background was... And the biggest thing was she started out as an enemy. She started out as Adora, who hated the rebels. And, of course, this was also in the years when Star Wars showed its face and changed the nature of movies forever. And of course, I stole that. And geniuses borrow, right? It's good writers just steal. we don't borrow, we steal right out of it. So I said, okay, well, I'm gonna make them the Great Rebellion. I said, we're gonna call them the Great Rebellion. We didn't call them the Great Rebellion. And I said, because on Eternia, He-Man and his group are in control. The king runs Eternia, and it's just Skeletor that's giving them trouble. You know, on Etheria, it was totally changed. It was a torn planet, and it was magic versus science or technology, really.
Right.
That made that show run. I said, so they got to be the underdogs. They got to be trying to take back their world, rather than He-Man, who's just really protecting his world. You know.
Right.
And then, you know, then we had to go. Then I had to work out the whole thing of how do you have a sister that we never managed to mention in 130 episodes, know, that even his parents never said anything about. You know.
Well, it all worked out, right? Yeah.
If you got magic to work with, you can work anything out.
That's right.
That's the beauty of fantasy. If you have magic with, you can say this is magic. And it's just as good as saying stem cells will cure Alzheimer's. You know, as to say like, okay. Cast a spell that can cure Alzheimer's. You'll cast a spell and it'll be over and you can think again. So there was no pulling me to a new project or really creating a backstory. And the reason for that is because we were doing another 65-episode show. And 65 episodes is a lot. We had to get everything in place. What I did do that was not much done with He-Man is that we learned a lot on He-Man. We learned a lot how to do a show like that better. And so the She-Ra show could be better still. And it could be for girls. But there were a lot of female He-Man fans as well.
Yeah.
Which the same, by the way, goes for Beast Wars.
Oh, yes. We'll get into that. Quick story. Bob Budiansky, who was an editor at Marvel Comics, wrote most of the backstory for the early Transformers line over a Thanksgiving weekend in 1983. And this guy is still amazed at the popularity of the stuff that he wrote way back then. How do you feel about the ongoing wave of nostalgia for He-Man?
Ooh, got me another job on the new He-Man. So I love it. If they want me to do a feature movie on He-Man, then I'll be really happy about the nostalgia for He-Man.
Hearing rumors about that, too.
Huh?
I keep hearing rumors about that He-Man movie.
Oh, there's always rumors about a He-Man movie, but they made one, and it bombed terribly because it was badly written. Although it was well done production-wise, but it was just, and I was working for him as well, Gary Goddard, who directed the movie at the time.
But you didn't have anything to do with the movie?
Only that I was working for. He directed the and then produced and directed the movie. The He-Man movie.
They had just stuck a little bit closer.
With everybody's head on a pike, I said, wait a minute, he obviously didn't watch the show, the writer.
I don't think
he ever watched a single episode.
That's right.
He did something else. He was doing Conan, you know.
Yeah.
I said, great.
I believe Goddard had mentioned on the commentary for that Masters of the Universe DVD, he mentioned that he was a big Jack Kirby fan, and most of the characters in that movie are based off of Fourth World characters and has nothing to do with He-Man whatsoever, other than putting in, like, Gray Skull and the sword and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was some of it. I thought Frank Langella was great as Skeletor.
He was.
You know, but Dolph Lundgren, I mean, he's not, you know, poor Dolph. I mean, you know, he's not the worst actor in the world, but at that time he was.
Dolph with his horrible mullet.
Why don't you give us the worst actor in the world? And people forget Courtney Cox was in that movie.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, yep. That's right.
He was the teenage girl in that movie.
Yep.
She's a cougar. That's what happened.
Yeah. Now, people, you know, also,
it's always nice to have people like what you did. And so when someone I don't scream at people who say, oh, tell me something about He-Man, you know, because I really loved it when I was a kid. I say, great, if you loved it as a kid, you love my writing. What am I going to say to you? You're an idiot for loving my writing. That would be dumb of me. You know, if you like what I wrote and, you know, it gave you pleasure and you remember to this day, you know, like, great, thank you. You know, that doesn't say anything bad about me, especially given the animation we had on the old He-Man. You know,
right.
Almost nothing moved. Although more moving than their Star Trek did. And in Star Trek, you could see nothing moving at any point in time.
Just their mouth kind of moved a little. Yeah.
Yeah. But the nostalgia is great for it, you know. And I don't get like over the top fans anymore. They're all grown up, and you know, they're not little kids. Yeah. But we had a lot of kid fans, and the kid fans I always was happy to speak to.
Nice.
And I still have He-Man fans trying to befriend me on Facebook, and if I can take a moment for a personal ad, that all the people have. Fan and friend both start with an F, but they're not the same thing.
Yeah.
If I don't know you, you're not my friend. Despite the fact you may be a fan of E-Man, but that does not make you my friend.
Did you set up a fan page?
Friend you that.
Huh? Some of the writers have fan pages and friend pages, and they will fan their fans and friend. They keep those two separate, I should say.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Of course they do. You know, but I just go on Facebook to, you know, upload pictures that my relatives can see. You know, just going to weddings and
right,
and stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, I'll talk to people. Message me over there, but you know, and I'll usually send one message back saying thank you, you know, and explaining that, you know, if I let everybody that was a He-Man fan on the page, I couldn't find anything on the page. It would be
thousands. Yeah,
you know,
now I know Christy Marks has two separate ones, one for fans and one for friends. I think she calls it like Christy's Playhouse. And speaking of Christy, she had mentioned that she had gotten the head writer position for Gem and the Holograms because the studio wanted a woman to write for the girls' toy line. What were the considerations in putting, you know, a man or men in charge of writing She-Ra?
Well, for one thing, we didn't have any female writers on staff at that time. We had plenty of them who wrote for us as freelancers. Because you can't do 65 episodes yourself, no matter how great you are.
Right.
You know, and we had a lot of, like, Dorothy Fontana from Star Trek. I mean, you know, she wrote the Origin of Cringer, which was a magnificent story. But Dorothy is gold-plated stuff. I like writing women. I do like writing women. I have a lot of experience writing. I wrote a novella which I never got published, but it was about a female warrior. It's a fantasy novella called Shadow of Wind Chimes. Never did get it. Thing. I think it doesn't really matter whether you're a man or a woman. It matters whether you can write and you can kind of feel what people feel. Nobody in Mattel said, well, you know, we'd like a woman writer to do it. If they had had a woman writer there, maybe she would have done it. But actually, it was just me, Robbie London, Roby Gorin. We only had about four or five writers.
Hmm.
And that was it. They were going to do it. It's dumb to go and hire somebody else to be like a story editor. Like, they never ever gave me a story editor thing, although I kind of worked. I did the job of a story editor on He-Man. But I did it for my own satisfaction because I certainly didn't get the money that a story editor would get for the same position.
Is that where the big bucks come from?
Huh?
Is that where the big bucks come in?
There's no such a putting big bucks in any thing with Filmation. Is not. It's just totally that's totally wrong. They never had big bucks because every penny Lou made went back into the company, which
right.
is why he was the best. He was my best boss ever. Lou Scheimer treated me like I was. He treated everyone like they were. He was just marvelous to work for.
Nice.
You know, but pay, there wasn't a lot of pay at that, even for the story editors. I mean, you didn't get the big bucks on a Filmation show because they just couldn't afford to pay it and make 65 episodes in a year.
Right.
You know, it just was an impossibility unless, you know, some millionaire, a billionaire or a gazillionaire had come along and given Lou, you know, $20 million.
Yeah.
I was always writing as if somebody had done that, but because all of my scripts, it would usually get the biggest thing on my scripts would not be, well, this line is no good or that. It'd be dollar signs. Hal Sutherland would always be saying, Larry, this is a terrific script, but we can't do it. He says, there's no way we can do this. It's too expensive. You gotta cut these shots down. You can't have this three-dimensional shot. And, you know, I just had to learn that it's when you're doing a limited animation show, especially on a short budget, there's only so much you can get away with. But, you know, we learned on the course of He-Man how to get away with it really well. How to make strength out of our weaknesses and how to apply it to and what you liked about the show wasn't the animation, it was the story and the characters. That's simply it. You might not have realized that at the time, but, you know, who does when you're a kid? You just look and say, "Oh, that's neat," you know. But you know, that's for us, for the writers. It's got to be okay. I told a good story, and I gave you some characters to work with, and that's why at the end of the first season of He-Man, I cataloged every episode and every character that was in it, and said, "Here's who we're bringing back, and here's who we're not bringing back." That's a story editor job, but I wasn't getting paid for it.
Yeah.
Eventually, I probably would have moved to producer, but I left Filmation after the first year of She-Ra.
Me and besides,
over to Deke.
Besides cartoons, what were you going to say, Larry?
We got bucks. We got more money. I was getting like three times more money than I was getting at Filmation.
Ah, well, that's always good. Besides cartoons.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, besides cartoons, our podcasts also mostly revolve around Transformers, so let's get into some Beast Wars stuff. How did you get involved with Beast Wars?
Okay, that would be Chris Bruff. Chris Bruff was the executive, the owner of Alliance Mainframe Entertainment, and the show was a Mainframe Alliance. There was some kind of a thing there, and now they're apparently Rainmaker Alliance. But Chris was an executive on that show, and they were the ones who did Reboot before Beast Wars. They were like the first guy. They really brought CGI to television. I don't know if there's going to be some. And no one ever kind of mentions that they were the Reboot. Remember Reboot? Remember Reboot?
Yep. Oh yeah.
Very early
Reboot
CGI stuff.
Reboot was fantastic. So when they talked to us, I was Bob Forward and I. They wanted both of us. For some reason, they thought we were a team, and we had to disavow them. We never actually wrote together, Bob and I. Once we did on Transformers Animated. But at the time, we weren't a team, but we both were with the same agent. So he was talking to the same agent, and she called and said, "Hey, there's a new Transformer series going. What do you guys think?" And I have to say, what we said is, "Oh, are you kidding? Transformers? We hate Transformers." Now, I know I shouldn't be saying this to a bunch of the Transformers fans, you know, but it didn't sing to either of us. But, you know, we were writers, and we were writers in need of a job. So we said, he wants to come down, and he was up in Vancouver, Canada. He's coming to L.A., and he wants to meet with you guys and tell you, you know, what this new show is and, you know, see if you guys want to work on it. So, well, you know, we're always willing to take a meeting. You know, always willing. Why not? You get a free lunch, for one thing. You know, and if you drink a little, you can get a couple of beers as well. You know, so, you know, that's any writer would go out for a beer and a couple of, you know, something to eat and
free
talk
beer.
About getting a job. You know, we love to do that, you know. I did it for Disney a lot, and I never had any intention of working for Disney. I spent a lot of money on beer at the thing. And a lot of the guys would say, "Oh, we know you don't want to work on it, but you might as well have lunch." I said, okay. Anyway, we had lunch with Chris, and Chris was he's a very dynamic guy, very nice guy. And he says, Reboot was a success for us. He says, but frankly, he said, the story sucked. He said, they weren't. He said, the stories, they didn't hold water. He said, if we had better stories, he says, I think the series would be on the air. He says, you two are kind of have a reputation as the best story guys in town. You know, I don't know if that's true or not, but that was his idea. So we left him with that idea that, yes, in fact, we were involved. So we said, okay. So he sat down and he told us about Beast Wars and Hasbro and all this stuff. And, you know, and we said, well, let us think about it. And, you know, we'll think about it. And he said, okay. So he went back to Canada, and we, Bob and I, talked about it. And then he called our agent, right? And he made us literally the offer you can't refuse. I mean, he made us an offer that no cartoon writer was getting at that time at all, except maybe Jeff Scott, who was CBS's main kid. They were paying him good, and Mark Evanier, they always were paying Mark well.
Yeah.
But, you know, guys, we weren't getting bucks like this. I mean, it was a ridiculous price, and it was literally a price we couldn't turn down. But this is nuts, you know. This is like 10 times what I made at Filmation. it was more than I was actually making at Beast Wars. I mean, on Babylon 5.
Wow.
I said, wow. I said, that's something, you know. Because we were being paid as both story editors and writers. So we would get quite a large amount of money for writing a script. They paid well. They paid well all down the line to the writers. We got more than anybody else, but the other ones were still getting paid over scale. Of course, Reboot, they had a lot of money at the time, and I guess they didn't care. We hoped that they never said, oh, geez, they don't know they're paying us as much. We got suckers here. We got to go for it, you know. So we had to do it, you know. The money was good, and we liked Chris a lot, and they were in Vancouver as well. So now we weren't going to move to Vancouver, but they didn't expect us to move to Vancouver. We had to make sure we were getting paid American money. Of course,
right.
At that time, American money was worth more than Canadian. Today, you'd rather be paid in Canadian money, but then American said it has to be American bucks.
Right.
And we went to work on it, and that was it. That's how we got involved with it. We really literally, I mean, we knew of the Transformers. We had never watched the show much, so we went out looking for, you know, how are we going to do this show and what's this show all about? And for me, it came from a comic, but it was not Bob's. Bob actually was the editor, but it was Simon Furman who wrote the Transformers comic books. I found that whole line of like G2,
right,
that he did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like about 13 episodes, and it was all sitting there in a comic book store for the cover price. I said, you're kidding me. I'll buy them all. I took the whole set, and I took it home. I said, this was good. That was getting it for like 65 cents a piece, you know, for
yeah.
comic books. And I said, wow, this was great. And I looked in there, and I said, wow, this is how we need to do the show. And now, these were G2 Transformers, you know, often they weren't Beast Wars characters.
Right.
But reading the comic, you just totally forgot they were robots. You just, mm-hmm. that's Simon as the writer. He gave Optimus this personality that was really multi-layered, you know. And I said, this is what we got to do. We got to play these characters like, you know, they're warriors, they're soldiers. They're in the biggest war ever, and they're real soldiers. And they can hurt, and they can feel pain, they can do all that stuff.
Well, you actually know? Brought Simon.
And I got all that out of Simon's thing.
You brought Simon Furman in at the end of the season run, right? Because he's credited as a writer.
Yes, that's right. He is. He did. He wrote one of the season 3 episodes, and it's very good.
Nemesis two-parter.
We wanted Simon just inspired us so much that. You know, also he knew all about G1 and he was a big Transformers fan and still is.
Mm-hmm.
He knew all this stuff, and the second guy that got us into it was Benson Yee. Yee, who has who started the Beast Wars site and stuff on that. So that got us into it, and we suddenly started to get, besides the money, we started to get really excited about how we could do this story. And basically, Chris was telling us, you can do what you want. You know, we have to go to Cincinnati and speak with Hasbro about it. But other than that, you know, you can do anything you want. And anything you want is exactly what a writer likes to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to go crazy. You know, so then Bob and I went to, you know, to write the Bible and that kind of stuff. That's how I got involved first with Beast Wars. Well, we've another seen, question, and I'll give you another answer.
Yeah, well, we've seen you've described as both a writer and an executive story editor for Beast Wars. Now, is that just you pulling double duty, or was there a promotion in there somewhere? Or basically, I mean, how do the two roles differ?
The two roles don't differ much. A story editor is a writer, and the thing is, we didn't get a promotion. That's the one thing we couldn't get, was a promotion. And that was not because they didn't like us, because we certainly gave them a show that hit the ground running and was a pretty big success. It's a Canadian law that you can't have a producer on a show who's not Canadian.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if that law is still in effect. Up in Canada, it may not be, that might have been changed, but at that time you just couldn't get an American producer, a British producer. It had to be a Canadian producer. You could be a story editor, executive story editor was as high as you could go. So we started the show as the story editors. The next year we became story editors, because it's a logic, because that's how the hierarchy works. You get promoted the next year to the executive story editor, which means you're still doing the same job. You're still a writer. The only thing about the only difference between a writer on a show and an executive story editor is the executive story editor is working both on his or her own stories and everybody else's that's coming there. And what you do as a story editor is you make sure that the tone of the show is right, the dialogue is right, the guy's got his information straight, the guy's doing everything he can with screen, with the scenes. And that's to get you ready for the next step would be producer. Now you'd still be doing the same job as producer. There's no difference between it. You're writing, except you're again writing on everybody. We wrote on everybody's scripts. In the best of worlds, like with Len Wein, you do one day of story editing with Len Wein, and you've got a script, because I knew Len could write a script that way, and trusted him from previous shows. I hired my friends. Bob fired his friends. Of course, we also had to have some Canadian writers on the show, and they came later on with people. So there's some people we gave a start to that I don't think have gone very far, because the start wasn't very good. So they got their first credit off of it, and we fixed what was wrong.
Right.
So there's no responsibilities changing when you become a story editor, or even when you become a producer. If you, as a matter of fact, there is a story editor. A friend of mine is a story editor on Warehouse 13, but he's like the only one I know of. Most people get a producer's deal, and I'm sure if Warehouse 13, which seems to be doing well, goes to next year, he will be a producer. If Bob and I could have got a producer credit, which they would have given us, I think, without that law. They just put...
Right.
They did give us some more money. so we could...
That's always good.
Yeah, money is good.
You've said that you weren't involved in the earlier Transformers series, so how did you come up with the whole idea of using the Generation 1 Transformers in the crashed arc in Season 2 and the...
Yeah, this is such a long story. I don't even know if we have the time to get it in.
Okay.
How many questions you got? Of course, I think my family expects me to be out here by 6:30. Anyway, I'll give you the fast version. Is that all came about by us going on WebSAR, on the Transformers website. Because once we started working on this show, I said, well, I want to know a little more about it. So, I go do what we always do. We go on a thing, and, well, there was no Google at that time, but I Googled it. And You know, and I said, you know, I said, boy, we're bucking like this cannon is like ridiculous. You know, we got, you know, there's like, I don't know, 1,000 transformers. And there seems to be one popping out of every wall, you know, every place. I said, you know, and I said, we need, you know, we need somebody on this. And there was also beginning the buzz of this is going to be terrible. This is going to make every Transformers fan totally angry. You know, you're never doing things right. You know, this will never work. You know,
that came later.
So we started to talk to people, and then at one point, I don't know, Ben became like a friend of ours, and he was giving us like archives on the old Transformers show. So we actually had the old archives that he had spent a lot of time on doing. And we'd look at this, and it was like every show that the Transformers had ever done, even some of the Japanese stuff, not just the American stuff. So it was the fans that got us into G1, and again, I got more interested in through Simon's comic book that did the G2 turnover, and I got an idea out of that. And then Bob got a couple of ideas from that, and then we started to talk about it. And, you know, it was... You know, it was a move that we felt Hasbro didn't like it. This is what was really weird. Our biggest problem came from Hasbro with this. They said, well, we're not trying to sell old G1 toys. We want Beast Wars store toys. So it has to be Beast Wars characters. But now there was one guy on the Hasbro. He wasn't a high executive. He was kind of an intern, and he also was an he was a walking encyclopedia of Transformers. He's one of those guys that grew up on Transformers, and so he went and got his dream job working for Hasbro, which I would never claim as my dream job. But I wasn't working for Hasbro. I was working for Mainframe.
Right.
That meant I could call them the head of Hasbro. Stupid name.
Oh.
To terrible names that she never realized I was calling her. Anyway, and yell at her.
You know that the whole tie-in, regardless of what Hasbro felt at the time, to us fans, that was just genius. I mean, just being able to go back and tie it into the current work of Beast Wars in season one, even though the tie-in was already kind of made a little bit. But we never knew that it was actually Planet Earth. How did the whole making it Planet Earth storyline come about? Like, how did you guys make the decision process to say, oh, hey, this is Earth now?
Well, again, we didn't really have that power. We didn't have the power to make that decision. That decision had to be made by Hasbro. So they were balking at it, right? And and the one guy on the panel there that really loved the G1 Transformers, you know, he was saying, no, this is good because it ties it in with the old show, and then maybe we can bring back the old show. Well, we all know what happened there, that they brought back movies even better, you know.
Yeah.
Once we just said the name Starscream, like on the, I forget what episode we used that in, but we, you know, said something about Starscream, or no, we just put one of the guys up in Canada, you know, put Starscream into a shot of kind of a flashback or a dream sequence.
Right.
I think it was in mine. I'm big on dream sequences. I think it was in one of my episodes.
And the cheater was having his dream.
Let's put someone in there. Yeah, and someone said, yeah, Starscream. He was real popular, you know, so let's put Starscream in there. And once people said, they said, was that Starscream? Holy crap, this is really Transformers. You know? And that's what started. It started a ball rolling. When we first did this, they said it's a prehistoric planet. There's no humans on it. There's nothing there but maybe some animals, you know, and the two Transformer sides. But it's not Planet Earth. It couldn't be, right? It had two moons. This is where the genius comes in on us, you know. When we were trying to get this in, we said, okay, listen, you know, if it turns out that it's not, we said, all right, it's not Earth. You've told us it's not Earth. It's not Earth. But that didn't change the thing. Cybertron was Cybertron in the old series. And that's where it came from. So we it was really, I think we did a superb job of kind of just finessing them into like, and then we'd show them like the stuff on the board. And look, people are screaming all over the place. Oh, now, well, who are we going to see next? Let's get this guy in. Now, of course, they didn't want that. Again, they were trying to sell these toys.
Right.
After all this going back and forth on this stuff, and this was about three or four episodes that already done and in, you know, somebody said to us, oh, well, let's make it Earth. You know, we said, oh, God, you know, you could have saved us so much trouble if you had just said that last time. This is Earth. Now, once we got to this is Earth, right, it was logical that the Ark was there. You know, it was just logical. You know, it made sense that the Ark was there, and that's how we got it in. It was less a decision than a finessing and a kind of an outcry from the people that say, we want our own Transformers. We love these new Transformers, but we want to see the old ones too. You know,
and we have
to blow
it
well.
and you had to blow up a moon.
Yes. That's right. We put up two moons. We said, listen, if it turns out that you want to make it Earth, we'll blow up one moon. And that's what I did. And, you know, I didn't tell them I was going to kill Optimus at the same time. But, and I got a lot of problems with that, believe me.
Nice. We like to hear it when voice actors have action figures from all of their characters that they have given their voices to. But did you collect action figures from the Beast Wars line?
No, usually they give them to you, you know. But they didn't give us. They gave us a couple of figures, but they didn't give us much. All the figures went to. This is the same on He-Man, by the way. The people who got the action figures were the artists because they had to draw them.
Right.
They figured, the writers don't need the action figures, you know.
Of course they do.
So, you know, we go, either sometimes they'd like give us some cast offs, like when we went to Hasbro. We'd go to Hasbro like once a year to, you know, see how things are going.
Yeah.
So they didn't really send us a whole lot of Beast Wars figures. I think I got a couple sitting around here somewhere.
The interview that you and Bob did on the Beast Wars DVDs, the one that Bob did, for some strange reason, there was an Optimal Optimus sitting next to him in the interview that he did for Bob Forward.
Oh.
I don't know if that was a prop or if that was actually his.
It probably was his, see, because Bob liked to get that stuff. Bob liked that stuff. he liked, you know. I liked him for staging scenes, you know, just kind of like mapping out your scene by using the toys. You're kind of playing with toys, aren't you? And also making money and playing with toys. It's fun.
That's what I would do.
That was fun, but and they're good to have. So you get, but everything that needs to be gotten right on the figures has to do with the artists and not the writers. So they don't always just. I will say on the new He-Man, they send me a whole box of figures, which is now in storage and in their original boxes.
It's a collector.
No fool here. That's my legacy.
Did you get a chance to talk with any of the voice actors about their roles as you had written them, or was there like a strict division between writers and actors?
Well, the thing is, we weren't there. We were here in Los Angeles. They were up in Vancouver.
That's right, yeah.
So there was not really a lot of stuff. We spoke to the voice actors with the year we went to the BotCon.
Mm-hmm. After that, yeah.
And came there, and there, you know, I mean, Scott McNeil was he was so, I couldn't believe that guy. That guy did like
interview we have been dying to get.
Yeah. I mean, Scott would basically be talking to himself all day from Beast Wars. You know, he'd have these things where it was all his characters, and he could do it. He could just go in and out of them like crazy. I mean, voice actors make you in cartoons. I mean, if you don't have good voice actors, you're dead in cartoons. And we had excellent, you know, not everybody, but most everybody was really excellent on Beast Wars where the voices were concerned. I mean, really, they were great. And Scott could do it all. You know, and Alec Willis just did Tarantulas. He did that one voice, you know. And Venus Terso did my favorite Black Arachnia lady. And that's half of why there are shrines to Black Arachne up on the internet all over the place. That was great to 12-year-old boys at the time. and a couple of the adults as well.
Yeah. Although the writing chores changed hands between Beast Wars and Beast Machines, would you care to speculate a bit and tell us what you would have done differently if you had continued with the franchise as far as going from Beast Wars to the new series Beast Machines?
Well, first of all, they never asked us to work on Beast Machines, ever.
Okay.
We were never considered for Beast Machines, and that was because the original Beast Wars was syndicated. Beast Machines was a network show. And the network saying, well, we can't have these guys that write syndicated. We have our own guys, both of whom, by the way, are friends of ours, Bob Skier and Marty. I don't know what the hell's Marty's last name.
Eisenberg.
Eisenberg, Marty Eisenberg, right. Just worked for the guy. I can't remember his name. they were acquaintances of ours. They were friends of ours. We had nothing against them. They didn't come looking for our jobs. They had done Godzilla, which was a big hit for Fox cartoons.
Yeah.
So they said, well, let's get Bob and Marty to do this, you know. Now, we'd been working on Beast Wars now for 2 years, and, you know, we could have worked on it again if they wanted us, but they didn't want us. So there was no even negotiation or even idea. Unfortunately, you know, they helmed the sinking ship. So it kind of worked out, you know, it's a little shame and proud there. But, I know that once you get in the network vein, it's very, very hard to get something good out of it because they have 100 things they don't want you to do and very little idea of what they do want you to do.
Mm-hmm.
So writing for Beast Machines would have been, I think, agony for us because it was not our characters, it was not our guys. They were changing, we had already changed them from their original Beast Wars to Fusors to Transistors or whatever we called them. I don't know. It was
Transmetals.
Transmetals, right? Transmetals. I said, you know, and then so now they're going to be Beast Machines. I said, so now you're back to the original Transformers, where you have an animal turn into cars, right? We wouldn't have done it. What we would have liked to have done, had we stayed on there, if they wanted to do another show, was to take them back to Cybertron with Megatron in pursuit of them. And eventually get back to Cybertron itself, because there was a lot going on Cybertron that was happening because it had happened in Beast Wars, and they had changed the timeline.
Right.
And they also had, you know, Optimus Primal's head shot off by Megatron, and a lot had changed on the Cybertron because of that. And that was really our dream was to go back to Cybertron, you know, and really get, or have them in space. We thought they worked better in space than they did on Planet Bound. You know, they could go anywhere in space, and we could put them off against a lot of stuff. That was the idea we had. But, I mean, once we knew that we were not going to work on it, we just stopped, you know, getting any ideas because it was not going to be our stuff, so we didn't care. Not that we didn't care about you guys. We cared about the fans, but, you know, we just didn't care about Fox and what they wanted to do because they didn't even give us a shot to write it. And consequently, you know, Bob and Marty got castigated by Beast Wars fans. They got the poor guys. I mean, they got the stuff that we got when we first started Beast Wars. But worse, because now everybody liked Beast Wars, and they didn't want to change to this next incarnation. I never saw it. I never seen a single episode of Beast Machines.
I love Beast Machines. I love Beast Wars, but I also I never, because I see it as one. I know you guys had stopped at season 3 of Beast Wars, and they brought in Marty and Bob, but I see it as one whole continuous story. That's just me personally, and I absolutely love Beast Machines. I love both series.
Okay.
Personally, I think that the writing for Beast Wars was a lot better than the writing for Beast Machines. Not because Beast Machines wasn't a good story. It's a very good story arc. It's a nice couple of season story arc. But in many places, the sequential storytelling was just off. Mm-hmm. It didn't work very well. It's hard to tell what's going on in some scenes, and things are hard to follow, or they don't make sense from moment to moment. I mean, if you hadn't seen it yourself, you probably have no idea. But I mean, if you had seen it, you probably could have picked it out right away.
Yeah, I would say so.
I mean, compared to your stuff.
No original family, easy. you can see stuff like that. I mean, it's not really Bob and Marty's fault. It's more the point there's too many hands in the pot on a network show. And everybody thinks that they have the greatest idea ever, and then the toy company is going to come after you with what they want, and they have no idea whatsoever of how to make a show.
Right. Well, to change gears a bit,
frustrated. You survive a toy company. That's you don't really work for them. You survive them.
To persevere.
Worst business in the world. They'll cut your throat in a minute.
I'm almost tempted to stick with that concept for a minute. See, changing gears. The animated series that you wrote for usually had a lot of other writers, each doing their own episodes. Like taking He-Man, for example. Was there any communication between the writers in order to help continuity or focus characters?
Yes. It was with us as we would take pictures. Again, doing a story editor's job, we're not getting paid for. But we were taking pictures from writers, and we would work back and forth with the writers, with the freelance writers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a story editor does. But we were staff writers, and staff writers do that as well. They didn't like us talking to the artists at Filmation. They thought we were fooling around too much and not working, that we should be at our desks. And we liked talking to the artists, because art is like a different thing from the writing.
Were you all in the same building?
Yes. Filmation. That was the beauty of working for Filmation. It was a complete animation company in one building.
Wow.
And it was the only one left in America. Even Disney wasn't doing animation that way.
I had always just assumed they shipped it overseas to be done or something.
No, none of the Filmation stuff was shipped overseas. It was all done in-house.
Shipped it overseas, ever.
Wow.
Would do it
that
all
was one of the beauties about it. Yeah.
So
that was one of the beauties of
it. We learned everything about animation at Filmation. We learned about recording. We learned about voiceover. We learned about in-betweeners and campaigners. We learned it all. And we go with them, and say, okay, here's what I want here. Can you do that? Can you draw? And we love talking to the artists because I can do this, And then they could sneak stuff in there that we couldn't sneak in because it was art.
That would be nice.
Yeah. You do communicate between writers, but once the script is done, you're off and you're on the next script. There's not a lot of time to sit around and talk in the way we used to do things 30 years ago.
Huh. What is the difference in writing for animation versus writing for live action, such as what you did with the Babylon 5 series? And follow up. Is it just a subject matter that changes from like kid stuff to more engaging?
It's not for kids. There's kind of an art to writing for kids where you don't give them too much to handle. Mm-hmm. Now I have a different take on it because I kind of write cartoons like they're live action, and I consider them not kid shows but family shows. I consider that. There's a six-year-old kid watching He-Man, and his dad may be sitting next to him watching with him, which was the case in a lot of... we had a lot of... Actually, 34% of our audience, we did a poll one time, were adults. Mainly those were college students, though. But they were older adults, too. And on Beast Wars, we had a lot of people that were, because we did some stuff on Beast Wars that was pretty tough for kids, like killing Dinobot and every other guy. We almost killed almost every other guy in Beast Wars. At the end of it, you know, and that's because Bob wanted to give. Bob said, "You know, I want to go out with us having completed as much as we could of our story and give it a signature closing," which he did, and
yeah,
very good. Very good. He's a very, very good forward.
We had blamed Simon Furman for killing everybody off. So
it wasn't Simon. It was, but you know, this isn't the thing about animated cartoon writers who write action shows. We're just dying to kill somebody because we never could do it before. they never would let us, you know. But I mean, my most vivid memory of Beast Wars is getting a letter from a guy who had watched Code of Hero with his kid, and the kid just burst into tears at the end of it. You know,
so
I mean, the kid was like, oh, he said, "Daddy, Daddy, you're talking about his dad," and he said, the guy said, "It was one minute I was kind of mad at you guys, and then I." He says, then he had this talk with his son about people live and people die, you know, which, you know, as parents, I don't know if you guys are parents, but I'm a parent.
Yeah.
If this is a talk you should have with your child at some point, you know, and that this lent itself to that. I thought that was, I said, oh, okay, we're really doing something good here. If they can watch that together, and at the end, of the kid was okay. He said, could we watch it again, Dad? You know, but really, Code of Hero was, that was the, to me, the best episode of Beast Wars was Code of Hero. And it was,
right.
That's also because Bob directed that as well.
Yes, he did.
I had no interest in directing. I can't even get up that early in the morning. I'm strictly a writer.
Since we brought up Dinobot's death, would you like to give us any behind-the-scenes info on the rejected Dark Glass script where supposedly he was supposed to come back to life?
Yeah, I knew you were going to answer that. Everyone asked that question. That was the famous Dark Glass controversy. What happened is that Chris, the first draft of Christie's script, we just simply didn't like the script. There was nothing. People said, "Oh, they censored it because it was too dark for kids." Sometimes. And I hired Christy Markson in a minute. Every show I ever worked on, I hired her for. I believe, if she wasn't in fact working on her own show at the time, and she's given me jobs a couple of times. So, you know, Christy is a great writer, but on that script particularly, it just didn't work. The script just didn't work, and you just don't want to put on a script that works because everybody hates you for it. On the other hand, that meant she had to go back. We paid her for the story, and I think the first draft. And I said, come up with something else because I said, there's no amount of work on this script that's going to fix it. It's just an instinct that you have that you know it's. Often they tell on He-Man, you say there's two kinds of scripts, producible and unproducible. Dark Glass was an unproducible script that wouldn't have worked. So she had to come back, and what did she come back with? She came back with Transmutate, which is my second favorite story on these. That story, that makes me cry.
that story was very deep.
Transmutate it's a very, very disturbing story. When you look at it, it's like an abused child story, you know.
Yep.
That was a 10 times better script than Dark Glass ever was, you know. And if we had done Dark Glass, she wouldn't have wrote Transmutate. So we got that script out of it. And I think it's one of the best things she's ever written. Hire Christy Marks out there, people. You don't have to hire me. I got plenty of money. But hire Christy.
What is your favorite character type to write for? Heroes, villains, or is there another type of character that you like better? Who gets the best lines?
Well, let me tell you who my least favorite character is in He-Man. It's He-Man.
Okay. It's He-Man, yeah.
You know, I like Hero's sidekick.
Orko.
Orko? Oh, no, Orko.
You said Hero's sidekicks.
Hmm?
You said Hero's sidekicks, and I said Orko.
Yeah, Orko. Yeah. Well, Orko, you know, I wrote a lot of Orko stories.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to work for the new He-Man, they said, we want you to do an Orko story. And I said, oh, yeah, shit, I knew they were going to do that. Oddly enough, they gave, you know, that was, I really enjoyed writing that story for the new He-Man, the lesson, the Orko story. I liked Orko, I like weird characters, and Orko was weird. And he's funny weird. I came back to the comedy. He was funny weird, and you could do things with Orko you couldn't do with anybody else. So I really did, at first, I didn't like him because he was the kid character, because every Filmation show has a kid character.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like kid characters. I hate kid characters. I'd like to blow them all up. You know? It's not that I don't like kids. I just don't like kid characters in action shows because they get in the way. And I'm not that crazy about heroes. You know, villains are always great to write for because you can bring your dark side out and write all this cool stuff for the villain. And, you know, you can kind of get all that stuff out of you there. But heroes, where do you go? I mean, you can't get your good stuff out there by writing for heroes. It just doesn't come out. It's just a hero. He's a hero, you know. He-Man is He-Man. I also wrote it one time for the Superman cartoon show. That was very hard because what do you do to Superman? That was the hardest character I ever wrote for because you have to figure out how do I defeat Superman. And there's only two ways, as far as I can see, have a character that uses magic and has a character and have Lois Lane kidnapped. Those are the two things. And Kryptonite. There's a third of Kryptonite, but I didn't want to go to Kryptonite on Superman. So I did two shows on Superman, which, by the way, when it came out, we called it Adequate Man. The animation is really bad. Anyway, I like villains, and I like odd characters, and I happen to like sidekicks a lot. I really do like sidekicks. You might say I like Pancho better than I like Cisco, like in Zorro, in Cisco Kid, rather.
Yeah.
You know, I like funny characters. I still have that idea that I'm kind of funny, and I like to do some funny stuff. But, you know, it's just a character that you can... I'm obviously, Tarantulas was my favorite character, which is kind of an odd pick because he's a total sociopath. But he was the only guy on Beast Wars that actually knew what was going on. I said, he's the only guy that knows the actual story that was never really fully told because I just didn't have the time to do it at the end of the season.
If only he would have exposition a little more.
Yeah, in the third season, we were only allowed to write two scripts each because we were more expensive than the other writers. And also, they just didn't want us to write too much on it. We wrote a lot in the first and second season, but and of course, since we were rewriting, we were kind of free writing scripts that didn't work, and so we kind of wrote it, but we didn't put our names on it. That's about it.
We just got a couple more questions, so we're almost done.
As a writer, what's the weirdest thing that has ever happened to you?
Oh, I don't know. the weirdest thing that's ever happened. You know, I don't really know.
Huh? Well, it's
I don't think anything weird has happened to me that has to do with my writing.
Let's try something else. Have you ever been asked to write something that you didn't want to do?
Oh, sure. But if I'm asked to write something I don't want to do, I don't do it.
Yeah. Well, besides Disney.
I did take the money on Transformers. That's true. But if I write something I really don't want to do, I don't think I could be good at it. I need to have a passion for it. And so what happens, if it's something, it's true, neither Bob nor I wanted to do the Transformers when we started with it. What we did was turn it around to a point where we could make it ours and say, we did this. And they gave us that opportunity by saying, okay, all you got to do is have these, you know, beast guys turn the thing, and then you have to make up everything else, you know. And the making everything else up. Since we didn't have to know anything, about the old series to write Beast Wars. That Dave Hasbro said that. They didn't give us any help there, except for Tony. That was the Transformers guy.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get something and, you know, you want the money or you need the money, you know, you make it your own, and that's the only way that'll happen to you. You know, so, but weird stuff, we're home all the time writing. nothing weird happens to us, you know.
So not Mickey much. Mouse never made you an offer that you couldn't refuse?
Oh, yeah, yes. Mickey Mouse, yeah, they wanted me to write Mickey Mouse mysteries. I said, I'm assuming I can't kill anybody. And they said, well, no, you can't. I said, well, then the heck with it. I wrote a Murder, She Wrote. And they read it, and they liked it. They liked my Murder, She Wrote script. So they said, oh, you can write mysteries. So maybe that's the weirdest thing that ever happened to me. Disney asked me to work for them about four or five times, and I turned them down every time. I didn't want to write Disney. I just really didn't want it. And something I don't want to do, Peter Pan. I worked on Peter Pan. I did want to do that. Until I saw how they were doing it.
Is that the one with Tim Curry as Hook?
The animated Saban series. I know, did Tim Curry play Hook?
I don't think it was a Saban series then. No.
No. Tim Curry played Hook somewhere else.
There was one where there was an animated series where Tim Curry played Hook, and it was awesome.
Yeah. Oh, Kurt, Tim does a lot of it. He does voice work, so.
Yeah,
he's the best thing for an actor. Yeah, that's what you want to do is work.
Yeah, anyway, we know you've attended BotCon once or twice. What was that like?
that was mind-blowing. That might be the weirdest thing that ever happened to me. I mean, Bob and I went to a BotCon out here that was out here in California. They asked us to come, and all the guys came down from Vancouver too. A lot of the voice actors came down to do it. That's where we met Scott, and unfortunately Venus didn't come. Oh, that character wasn't in yet. Because Venus is pretty good looking on her own. So we all like to meet them. I've gone to BotCon and tried, but what we didn't realize was how international this thing was. I mean, we were meeting fans from Germany, Japan. They said, well, you know, want you guys to do like a panel and then sit down like at the autograph booth so people can get your autograph on stuff. And we said, oh, are you kidding us? No one ever asked us to sit at an autograph booth. No one wants our autograph. We were signing autographs for 5 hours. This is ridiculous. We said, what have we done here? Have we made people crazy or what? Why do they want our autographs? I mean, it was nice. It was fun. It was fun to see that so many people were into this from all over the place, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I never realized it was such an international phenomenon. I mean, I realized that it's being started in Japan and went on, but the anime didn't travel that far in those days.
Well, know, what year was that? Was that 96 or 97?
That would probably be 96. Or it was in Anaheim. It was the year BotCon was in Anaheim. At the Anaheim Convention Center out by Disneyland.
Right.
So that might, that should have been like, and then Black Arachne came later, so yeah, that should have been 95 or 96. I've been to Comic-Con. Doing a He-Man panel. There's a convention here I always used to go to, LostCon, which is a sci-fi convention. So I go there and do the Dog and Pony Show with Joe on Babylon 5, which always was a big. That was exciting.
Yeah.
Until I got fired. But that's a weird thing that happened to me. But I like, I'm known as fan friendly, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if you come up there, you know, as long as you don't, you know, talk my ear off or start sending me links to things. I don't want to hack too many times to want links and meetings. You know, I'm grateful for fans. It's nice to have fans. you know, they're, and most of the ones I've met have been very nice to me. I don't have anybody that was rude to me, or, you know, sometimes they just go overboard, that they're so happy to talk to you, they're like, you know, trailing you like a piece of toilet paper on your shoe, you know. hey guy, you know, like I'm, you know, or, you know, if you're having dinner and, you know, people coming and sitting, they want to sit down and, you know, come on, man. Most of the fans, they were, and the kids were great. The kids were always great, and their moms would bring them up, and, you know, they'd come to me and say, oh, and I'd, you know, I'd say, oh, I'll send you a cell or something, and I'd send them some old cell, and they'd love it. It's
good,
nice. You know. It gives you some kind of awareness that you're actually doing something that people like.
Yeah.
And very few of us get that in life. So it's all good.
Yeah.
Except for the money at Filmation, but but that was all good in terms of learning the business and working for just a truly great man.
Yeah. We know recently, well, now, about a year and a half ago, you wrote an episode for Transformers Animated called Predacons Rising with Bob Forward. Was this the first time you had written with him since Beast Wars?
Yes. That happened with Marty. I saw an episode of Transformers Animated, and it was amazed because it's totally different. It's all of the Transformers. You know? It covers all the shows, but they hadn't done much on Beast Wars, and so they had one more. They had asked us to write for it, and again, I said, you know, well, we're not really a team. Again, we're not a team, you know. But they said we have only one episode left. Because both of us went, you know, we figured we get a job down there, and I liked it because it was humor based.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was kind of for smaller children to like the Transformers, and the animation, which was like flash animation, was oddly appealing, you know. And they said, we want to do a thing, and you know, about.
Larry?
Okay, yeah, hold on a minute. My wife just walked in and handed
this me. This is our last question. We're going to wrap up after this. So this is our the question that you're answering right now is the last one.
Okay. What was I saying before I was so rudely interrupted?
It was a story about Predacons Rising. They had approached you about doing Beast Wars stuff.
They said, we want to do this. They said, you can do anything you want. And they said, well, we want to have like a Beast Wars homage in it, and of course they wanted to use Black Arachnia, who was my other favorite character, right? and Waspinator, and you know, it was really the origin of Waspinator. So we did that show. I did not actually write a single page of the script. Bob wrote the whole script, but he wrote it very much to a very intricate story I had done. So I had done the story, and he just took it and put it into script form. And but when I was writing, I said, how are we going to end this? You know, I said, okay, they're going to teleport away. And I just said this one. I said we see silhouettes in the background of like Optimus and you know, Rhinox and stuff like that. I said, and Black Arachnid looks up and says, you got to be kidding. And they said, great! Great! Fantastic! And I saw it, and it was good.
That was the best ending ever. Yeah. We were actually having a conversation.
I can't believe they get away with that.
Oh. Who were we talking to? Derek J. Wyatt, who was the lead designer on that site for that show. We were talking with him about, you know, what did that mean? What does that mean? He's like, look, you know, don't read too much into it. And it's like, no, seriously, what happened there? But
who knows?
Yeah, it sounds like you would be the guy to ask.
You know, they may be on the, you know, Black Arachnid may be on the Beast Wars planet. Damn this with time.
that's so awesome. All right, so we would like to thank Mr. DiTilio for taking the time to talk with us. It was very enjoyable to talk with you, sir. Is there any way that if fans wanted to interact with you, is there any like way that you would allow fans to do so? Have you set up a fan page on Facebook separate from your personal account?
I have not set up a fan page on Facebook. And I don't really want a place that fans can get to me easily because I'm going to be swamped.
Okay.
You could, if you wanted it, you could send me a message on Facebook. And I don't go there that much. So,
okay.
A lot of fans send me messages, and I usually will write them back. But I don't want to start, like, 1,000 messages coming to me that I have to.
Right, right. We understand.
You can take your chances. you may get a, if you say something interesting, you may get a response.
Okay, very cool. So thank you for joining us here on the Geekcast Radio Network. Good luck with your current work. We will ask you to hold the line, and we'll be back with the outro after this.
We'll return to the Beast Unleashed podcast after this.
Folks over at GeekCastRadio.com, and I want you to listen to it because it's the world's first Beast Wars and Beast Machines review podcast. If you don't listen to it, I will send my vehicles to remove your sparks and destroy you. So, from now on, you will listen and tune into the Beast Unleashed.
Now, back to the Beast Unleashed podcast.
You have just heard over an hour's worth of questions and answers with us from Larry DiTilio. Wow, that was awesome.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun.
That was very, very awesome.
It's like hanging out for a while with Larry and just, you know, hearing his stories.
Yep, very, very cool. And I kind of like what we said in the interview, I mean, I grew up watching He-Man. A lot of us grew up watching He-Man.
Yep.
And, you know, I got a couple of years ago for my birthday, my mom got me all 4 volume DVD sets at the, because that's all He-Man is in right now, is the old entertainment rights volume DVD sets. And I've watched every special feature on there, and it's him talking. I've watched almost every episode with commentary. Most of the times it's him with Lou Scheimer, and it's just amazing. I was going to ask him about the Masters of the Universe Classics line, because they finally did a show-accurate Orko, but we just didn't have time for it. What are you laughing at?
No, I was reminded that he was talking about the rise and fall of He-Man and how He-Man rose and fell, and I'm thinking he did that in 2002 too. Kind of like, oh well, this is going to be a really good series, and then it, died on the vine, and right about now, Mattel is laughing all the way to the bank with their collector series.
Yeah, well, the thing about the 2002 He-Man was they didn't get picked up for another season, so it didn't really die. They just, it actually almost really, I like the two series, the Filmation series and the Mike Young production series, which was the 2002 cartoon. I like them in their own perspectives because, obviously, the original series was, it's the nostalgia in me. The 2002 series gave the He-Man mythos actual continuity throughout that entire series, whereas the old He-Man shows are basically one-shot stories.
Yeah.
Each episode. And, yeah, I like them both.
I love the 2002 series. It's just the toys didn't sell very well, so they had to axe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, I mean, being a Transformer collector and not allowed to have two more than one collection, I should say.
Well, there is one toy that you got away with, thanks to
Phineas and Ferb. Yeah, I do have a Doofenshmirtz still on my desk. So that's awesome.
So anyway, we're getting way off track here. So
yeah,
this has been the interview of Larry DiTilio, and it was a great pleasure to talk to Larry. I wasn't even, you know, and we got to thank Christy Marks, because really she's the one that talked to him about it. To even get me his contact info to contact him for the interview. So that's it, and I guess we're out of here. Thank you.